Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
The one in Kenosha, Wisconsin, it's plainly an underage kid. They should not have had a weapon, but he did get attacked, and he it was self-defense.
I think Georgia is a killing. Cell phones and police support were available to both of these situations.
What does it mean to be a father with kids? I carry a gun to protect my own family. We take on a huge amount of responsibility and liability, and we go through a lot of training to go through this.
They are legal coverage for bullies and racists.
Stand your ground laws and self-defense remain hotly contested topics in the U.S., and as we just heard, among some of you. Two high-profile court cases illustrate this now more than ever. In the Wisconsin case of Kyle Rittenhouse, his attorneys argued he was acting in self-defense in the shooting deaths of Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum during a Black Lives Matter protest last year. Meanwhile, in Brunswick, Georgia, the state has rested its case in the trial of three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. Arbery was shot and killed in February of last year. The defense for Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and their neighbor William Bryan Jr. argued they believed Arbery was attempting to burglarize a home. The prosecution says he was simply going for a run and was unfairly targeted due to his race. After the break, we'll discuss self-defense law in this country and whether or not it's applied equitably across race and gender in the courtroom. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. I'm Jen White. Remember to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think. Tweet us at 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing self-defense laws in the U.S. Joining us in studio is Mary Ann Franks. She's a professor of law at the University of Miami and author of The Cult of Constitution. Mary Ann, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts is Caroline Light. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard and director of undergraduate studies in women, gender, and sexuality. She's also the author of Stand Your Ground, a history of America's love affair with lethal self-defense. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Hello, I'm honored to be here.
And from South Florida, we have Tamika Bradley Hobbs. She's an associate professor of history and founder of the Florida Memorial University Social Justice Institute. Tamika, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Tamika, you've studied dozens of self-defense cases over your lifetime as a historian. How are you preparing for the outcome of these cases?
I have to say that I don't hold out a great deal of hope, as in the case of David Chauffin last year. I just really read the headlines and prepared myself for the worst. In that case, I was pleasantly surprised. But the lessons that I have learned since 2012 with the murder of Trayvon Martin. Watching the trial of George Zimmerman has really dimmed my hope in these types of cases. And so as a historian, and I've written about lynching and racial violence here in Florida, my book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, really tackles that topic. I am very interested in this continuing pattern of vigilantism. I know we're talking about stand your ground on self-defense, but that theme, that idea, that type of action actually is a thread that takes us through the 19th and 20th century to the modern time. And this idea, especially among white men, that they have the ability to be able to arm themselves and to engage with people that they assume are criminal is a very longstanding trend that has roots in the institution of slavery. And unfortunately, some of the things that have not changed are the assumption of the innate criminality of Black people and Black men. And so this is a continuation of that. I think there's been a great deal of progress on many fronts, but in terms of our society and our laws and systems are a reflection of our society, those two things, the support of vigilantism and gun laws and the belief in the criminality of Black men are really tied together in both of these cases.
I just want to note, you said David Chauvin earlier in your answer, or you were actually referring to Derek Chauvin there. Caroline, you've been following self-defense cases in this country for years. What are some of the unique characteristics of the Rittenhouse case?
First, I just want to echo everything that Professor Hobbs just said about this long-standing history, that in many ways this is a recurrent theme in United States history dating all the way back, I would argue, to settler colonialism and the use of the weaponization of self-defense by predominantly European-descended men to spread the frontier westward and basically claim that Native so-called savages were the aggressors. So it's the role reversal of victim and perpetrator that we're witnessing here. What's unique about this case, and what's to me particularly frightening about this case, is that it's expanding. I mean, if we see an acquittal today, it's expanding the boundaries of self-defense, even stretching further beyond what we've seen, because I believe Wisconsin does not have a formal stand your ground law. And Professor Franks can chime in, too, if she has more information on this. But they don't have a formal stand-your-ground law. But what we're seeing with this is, if there is an acquittal, this notion that you can take a deadly weapon, in this case a military-grade weapon designed specifically to kill and to do so as efficiently as possible, and walk into a space that is already volatile and claim that you were there to protect. So to claim the mantle of protection, to claim the mantle of vigilante heroism, and then when someone tries to disarm you, you have legal license to kill. And this, to me, I think is terrifying. And I think this is where I see this expansion of the weaponization of self-defense. And it's very selective. It's not going to be applied evenly across identities and communities. But I think that's one of the things that I'm looking out for in the verdict of this case.
Marianne, from a legal framework, how is self-defense defined within the law? And do we see great variation from state to state?
For hundreds of years, we didn't see all that much variation. What we saw was that the law of self-defense was meant to be restrictive of the use of deadly force, that we put a premium on human life, and that we encourage people to find other ways to resolve their conflicts. The only exception to that being in your home. In your home, you're not required to retreat. You can make certain assumptions about the harm that somebody means to you. And what we've seen, though, in the last decade or so with the advent of stand your ground laws has been this push to expand the notion of deadly force and when you can use it and for what purposes you can use it. And what it really has done is it's tried to take that exceptional state of your home, your castle, and turn it out to the entire world and make it the rule so that the entire world becomes your castle. And the problem with that, among many things, is that it is already racially charged. That is, even before you got the Stand Your Ground revolution, you had a disparate impact of self-defense laws. That is, white men in particular were justified or found justified in killings, particularly of black victims. And the same isn't true in the other direction. So there was already this racialized use of force. Stand Your Ground makes it worse. As Caroline has mentioned, Wisconsin doesn't specifically have a Stand Your Ground law, but self-defense laws in general, there has been a trend over the last decade to really make sure that certain members of society, in particular white men killing black people, that they feel emboldened and that they can experience some sense of impunity. And as many others are pointing out, it isn't just a question of individual cases and whether or not in a particular case someone gets acquitted. It has more to do with the impact that it has on emboldening certain people who already want to get into a fight, who are ready to be aggressive, and who now interpret the law to tell them to go ahead and do that, to show up with a weapon, make a volatile situation worse, and to escalate conflicts that could have been resolved peacefully.
Our legal system works on the presumption that some of the key actors, judges, the jury, will act impartially. And Marianne, there's been lots of commentary about the actions of Judge Bruce Schroeder, who's overseeing the Rittenhouse trial. How do judges shape trials?
Well, they can shape them in many ways, for good and for bad. Part of what the importance of the judge's role is to try to maintain that air of objectivity, to try to keep some of the emotions out of the courtroom and to not indicate any kind of bias or favoritism towards either side. The concerns that have been raised in the Rittenhouse trial is that the judge at certain times has seemed to make decisions and to behave in a certain way that seems to be aggressive towards the victims in the case here. For instance, the ruling that they couldn't, the dead men in this case could not be referred to as victims, which in itself is not an unusual ruling, but then at the same time saying you can refer to them as arsonists or looters if you have the evidence to support that. That suggested that there seems to be at least the impression that the judge might be taking sides.
Marianne, I want to briefly touch on the jury makeup for the trial of the McMichaels and William Bryan Jr. in Georgia. There's been criticism that there's only one black juror. How have we seen jury selection shape trials?
Well, historically, we've seen that black people and women were excluded from serving on juries. And this was part of the legacy of our criminal justice system and the bias that is sort of written into it structurally. Now, those formal exclusions no longer exist, but we see and we have reason to be concerned that those are carried over into the practices today. So now you're not supposed to be able to exclude jurors based solely on their race or on their gender. But what you see very often is a lawyer who's excluding on these challenges for reasons that are not maybe technically or explicitly because of race or gender, but you suspect that that is driving the reason to exclude those jurors. And so we're ending up with skewed juries when it comes to race and to gender.
And I should mention here of the 16 total jurors selected, that includes four alternates, five are men and 11 are women. Now, the Rittenhouse case in Wisconsin and the case against the McMichaels and William Bryan in Georgia do have that key fundamental difference that there is a Stand Your Ground law in Georgia. But the defense for Kyle Rittenhouse is arguing he still acted accordingly under Wisconsin's self-defense laws. And we got a question about that from Rodney in Virginia.
I don't even know what Stand Your Ground laws are specifically. And I would like someone to explain to me what is the difference between that and self-defense. If someone invades your home, you're allowed to defend. If someone confronts you personally in public, you're also allowed to defend. So what is the distinction between Stand Your Ground and self-defense?
Marianne, what do you think?
Well, that's an important point to make, which is that the difference between the two is maybe one more of terminology. That is, the Stand Your Ground movement is attempting to expand the notions of self-defense that we've had for some time. The distinction between you are allowed to defend yourself, yes, basically anywhere, that is true. The difference is, in nearly every jurisdiction before Stand Your Ground, that meant that you could defend yourself without retreating. You didn't have to look for non-lethal means of defending yourself when you're in your own home. The assumptions behind this are that no one should have to leave their own home to avoid a conflict, and that you have a right to be in your home. The other idea, though, is when you're out in public, if someone is trying to be aggressive with you, you do have the right to defend yourself, but you also have a duty to retreat from the situation if you can in complete safety. What Stand Your Ground says is, actually, no, you don't. You can have the same understanding, that is, that you would have in your own home, essentially everywhere in the world. So if you can presume that someone is intending to hurt you in a way, you can also do that outside of your home, and you are not obligated to find a non-lethal means of trying to escape from that situation, which is quite a radical revision of self-defense laws. In addition to which, Stand Your Ground also, in many states, gives the people who are invoking that defense the right not to be arrested, not to be prosecuted. And so it is this really massive change procedurally and substantively in terms of the use of deadly force.
When it comes to the Rittenhouse case, a key question is whether jurors will consider his actions in the moments right before the shooting or his actions in the days and hours leading up to it. Scott from Pittsburgh called in with this.
On an early episode of South Park, Stan's Uncle Jimbo explains that the way to get around laws restricting when you can hunt is to shout, "It's coming right for us," before opening fire. Likewise with Stand Your Ground, what's to stop someone from saying, "Oh no, they were coming right at me, I had no choice," when in fact it was murder?
Now, of course, South Park is a satirical program, but Scott poses a key question here, Marianne. How significant are the moments right before a shooting and convincing a jury the actions are indeed self-defense?
Yes, and that's a question that's important regardless of whether you're dealing with a Stand Your Ground state or not, because in both Wisconsin and in Georgia, the question is, which moment in time are we concerned with? If you walk into a situation and you provoke people by pointing a gun at them or by chasing them down, and they attempt to defend themselves or they attempt to stop you from hurting others, and you use that as an opportunity to then retaliate with force, that's a real problem. But it certainly is the case in many of these states and potentially in Wisconsin as well, that they're going to reward you, that the law will reward you for that. You create a situation in which other people are going to be aggressive towards you and out of good reason, good guys with a gun, right? The kinds of things that the NRA, which is one of the most important parties in terms of encouraging the spread of Stand Your Ground laws, that mythical good guy with the gun is the one who's going to end up getting shot and killed. Now, Wisconsin law says if you can show that the aggressor did these provocative things in order to provoke this kind of force against him and then use that as an excuse to kill them, that person is not going to be entitled to self-defense. And we'll see whether or not the jury in this case thinks that about Rittenhouse.
Caroline, I want to just return to the title of your book, Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. And that's a provocative title. What is at the core of what you call this love affair?
Yes, we increasingly witness that we live in a nation that is deeply in love with the very objects that are causing massive death in our nation. This has changed significantly in just the past few decades prior to the instantiation of Stand Your Ground laws, which, as Marianne pointed out, were promoted and developed with incredible support and help from the NRA. But it is the proliferation of deadly weapons into the hands of ordinary citizens that we're watching unfold right now in this very moment. For instance, states are passing these laws that they are calling constitutional carry, which is clever marketing for basically anybody without a license or any training is authorized to carry firearms outside of the home in the interest of their self-defense and safety. So it's the cathection of this love for firearms alongside an appeal to so-called universalized self-defense. But as we can see in these courtrooms, it is not universal. It's actually applied very selectively. And the people who are invoked by the appeal to heroic vigilanteism know exactly who they are.
We're discussing self-defense law with the cases of Cal Rittenhouse in Wisconsin and three men in Georgia, Gregory and Travis McMichael, and William Bryan Jr. We'll be back with more in just a moment. A reminder that you can join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app, and leave us a voicemail.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Best Fiends. When it comes to match three style puzzle games, only one reigns supreme, Best Fiends. It's an action-packed adventure game and puzzle game rolled into one, so it's no wonder it's got so many five-star reviews. Plus, there's new content added all the time. If you're tired of crushing the same old candy, give Best Fiends a try. You can download Best Fiends free on the App Store or Google Play Store. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to our conversation about self-defense following the case of Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin and that of the McMichaels and William Bryan Jr. who chased and killed Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. Now, both cases we've been talking about involve actively using guns, but discrimination in the law can extend to just owning a gun, as we heard from one of you.
With gun carrying laws, minorities don't really have the luxury of utilizing those as well, considering when a minority is carrying a firearm that they own with the permits and everything, police are automatically called and those situations quickly escalate.
There are numerous high-profile cases in which a person of color is carrying a legal firearm and is shot due to a perceived threat they may pose. You can think about Amantic Fitzgerald Bradford in Alabama, among others. Tamika, how does that discrimination about who has the perceived right to bear arms influence Stand Your Ground cases?
I think, you know, Marianne has written about this and spoken about this. I go back to the fact that in our society, our laws are an expression of our beliefs. And I want to go back to something that Marianne actually said about the weaponization of Stand Your Ground and about people being emboldened by the law. And in particular, white men. I think that's something that's very important to uplift, not just in this particular moment, but for me, something that stretches back to 2008. It stands at the intersection of our society, our psychology, and the law. And that is the perception of the threat. There is a very real perception that began with the election of Barack Obama that was really inflamed by Donald Trump during his presidency, that white men, whiteness generally, and white men in particular, are under attack. And so if you take that outlook and then pair it with the increased ability to use firearms without appropriate accountability, it creates a very dangerous environment. And it's one that reminds me of the period of lynching that we have lived through in this country. As it is not an exact parallel, but there are very troubling threads that run through all of this. As I mentioned previously, the idea of vigilantism, and that's what I see in both of these cases with Rittenhouse, the McMichaels, and with Bryant, the belief, deep belief, that they are entitled to use their firearms to go out and to cause harm simply based on their own judgment without the use of our criminal legal system, and then expect to enjoy protections under that law. And so we have to really dig deep as a society, the collection of us, especially after last year. This case, of course, in Kenosha came out of the shooting of Jacob Blake, shot 7 times in the back, and among many other instances, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, among them, that we began to have these types of deeper discussions. The arguments that had been made for many years, again, stretching back to Trayvon Martin and beyond, about the need for more attention to issues like this, we're finally being heard. I think it is up to us. This is a part of the continuing struggle for us as citizens to decide what types of laws that we want to inform our society that are reflective of our values. And we have a very critical opportunity now to take a look and to evaluate those.
Marianne, it occurs to me that there is this sense that citizens are in some way empowered to act as law enforcement. In recent months, I've seen many instances of people trying to make citizens' arrests. Where does that intersect with this conversation?
It has so much to do with what happened in these cases. You have almost signals, essentially, to who it is that feels entitled to become the protector of society. So in the Arbery case, for instance, you have these defendants saying, we were trying to make a citizen's arrest. You've seen that same kind of defense being promoted for the kidnapping plot of Governor Whitmer. So you see that there are certain members of society, there's a sub-community, right? And it's exactly as Tamika is saying, we have to name who that is. There is a culture of white male grievance that encourages white men in particular to feel that they are under attack. And when you are talking about a culture that has guns everywhere, especially states like Wisconsin and Georgia, where open carry laws exist, you're now talking about not just psychological grievance, that someone feels hurt all the time or afraid all the time. You are encouraging those people to take their fear and to do something violent with it. And that is very much the message that's being sent. It's very much the message that's being received. There was one of the callers who was saying, imagine the situation had been reversed, that you've got two black armed vigilantes chasing down a white person. And one of the reasons why it's so hard for us to imagine that is because most black men are aware that if they tried to do that, that they would most likely end up dead. So we have this understanding of seemingly neutral laws that are coded in a certain way, historically and otherwise, and through cases like this, that is encouraging a certain segment of the population to constantly feel that it is under attack and to take that sense of attack extremely literally and take up arms against it.
Over the past year, many U.S. institutions have been grappling with the ways systemic racism may have shaped their respective industries. And from your perspective, Caroline, have those working in courts, from judges to attorneys to clerks, been required to engage in these conversations?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there has been some lip service to efforts to implement some kind of equity or inclusion or to push back against these kinds of these notions of grievance, especially white masculine grievance, that are out there and also embedded in the law as well as our culture. I don't think they've been well implemented. I mean, I think there's plenty of evidence to show that this isn't being implemented. In fact, what it feels like is that we're looking at a moment of backlash, serious backlash against efforts to expand ideas of equity, to push back against historic exclusionary principles embedded in our law and our culture and our values that Tamika was talking about. It feels like what we're witnessing right now is that wave of backlash in response to that that exacerbates this notion of grievance and the capacity to act on that grievance by taking up arms and walking out into the street and pushing back against these protests, these demonstrations that we're witnessing. So to me, I see this as a symptom of a backlash moment where there are so many actors out there who feel threatened by appeals to inclusion, appeals to render our legal structures actually in a way that would meet our ideals, our ideals of American democracy.
Caroline, what pieces of self-defense law or stand your ground do you think are commonly misinterpreted or people just get wrong?
I think this idea of what's reasonable that Marianne was talking about. So one is the idea that reasonableness is a neutral, a value-neutral term, when really embedded in that appeal to reason are all of our nation's suppositions around gender and race and class and ability and other identitarian frames. The other piece, too, that I think is really important and contested is the idea of initial aggressor that Marianne was talking about before, and the idea of chronological distortions that happen in the courtroom that freeze the frame, as you said, Marianne, around this moment when the defendant needed to defend himself, but leave out the prior chronology of potential aggression or provocation. And we can also look in various, you know, at various courtrooms that where a woman's claims, back to the idea of like intimate partner violence, where a woman claims to have been in fear for her life and the kinds of chronologies that are imposed in those courtroom dramas, they're not equal, even if they look on the face like they are neutral. So I think that's a key component to this, is we want to believe that our laws are neutral, that they aren't, you know, encoded with explicit racial bias or gender bias or class bias, but as we can see in these multiple courtroom dramas, they continue to be embedded in those structures.
Tamika, any last thoughts? What would you like people to think about as we consider these laws and the potential outcome of these cases?
I would just like to ask for continued commitment to allyship and standing on the side of those who often are the most victimized, whether we're talking about vigilantism, whether we're talking about police violence. Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum lost their lives standing in solidarity with protesters who were standing against the violence that Jacob Blake had seen. There were so many others who took to the street of this nation and around the globe to stand in solidarity. I would just ask for continued solidarity in pushing for real substantive change that will address these laws and account for some of the implicit bias that we see operating through them.
That's Tamika Bradley Hobbs, Associate Professor of History and founder of the Florida Memorial University Social Justice Institute, Marianne Franks, Professor of Law at the University of Miami and author of The Cult of Constitution, and Caroline Light, a senior lecturer and the Director of Undergraduate Studies at Harvard's Women, Gender, and Sexuality Program, and also author of Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Thanks to you all. 1A's week of listener picks is coming up, and we'd love your help with this annual tradition of ours. Every January, we take your pitches and turn them into a week's worth of shows. So you suggest a topic, the audience votes on which topics they want to hear, and then we produce them and bring them to you. So if you have a pitch for us or an idea that's been rolling around in your brain, or maybe it's just something you'd like to hear more about on our airwaves, leave a comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. We'll collect your pitches through November, put them to a vote in December, and in January, you'll hear them on the air. So leave us a pitch, comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Today's producer was Chris Remington. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.